them lying hard. To hear them lying hard on the wings of love, up and above the clouds, the only way to fly is on the wings of love. On the wings of love, only the few of us to hear them lying high. Of love.
I know that I don't wanna lose. If I could tell the world just one thing, it would be we're all okay. I'm not so worried, 'cause worry is wasteful and useless in times like these. I won't be made of hurt, won't be idle to despair. Gather myself around my face, the light of the darkness won't fear. My hands are small, I know, but they're not yours, they are my own. They're not yours, they are my own, and
Thank you for standing by. Today's conference will be recorded. If you have any objection, you may disconnect at this time. Ma'am, you may begin your call.
Thank you. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Harm Telecon for August of 2007. I'm Amanda Hendricks, and I'll be hosting the telecon today. And today we're going to hear about Hyperion observations and other observations of Hyperion, and are joined by Dr. James Bauer of JPL and Dr. Peter Thomas of Cornell University, both of whom work on observations and data analysis from the... Dr. Bauer works primarily on the spectrometer, and Dr. Thomas works primarily with data from the subsystem, the camera. And so... and Dr. Bauer is at JPL, and Dr. Thomas is at us. So we will get started, and I think, Dr. Bauer, you're going to start?
Yes, okay. Yes.
And
thank
then,
you.
And then
thank
we'll segue into Dr. Thomas. And usually we sort of allow people to interrupt you with questions.
That's fine.
Okay, great.
That's fine. That's okay. Fine. And I think I'm going to cover more of the compositional data and the spectral from the VINs, and Peter, I think, is going to cover more of the ISS imaging and the shape models and rotation and whatnot for Hyperion. But I wanted to start by just kind of thinking of Hyperion in a larger context. This kind of lead in gently into the topics, but so Hyperion is one of over 60 moons of Saturn, 60 known moons. A large fraction of these moons are a few kilometers in size, and they're either distant irregular satellites, hundreds of Saturn radii away from the planet, or are a few. A few Saturn radii from the planet. But there are several things that make Hyperion special. It's the eighth largest satellite, and it's one of the what are considered the major satellites of Saturn. It's one of the three darkest satellites, and its albedo is about 0.25, and it's the third furthest out of the major satellites. Of course, it's a chaotic rotator, so its rotation axis wanders. Its density is surprisingly low, but again, Peter, I think, will go into that a little more, in detail. And it's irregularly shaped. The surface, of course, looks like a sponge, as the lead slide shows. It's full of pores. At the bottom of these pores or craters, there's a dark material tends to exist there, and it's very variable and patchy with dark and light, highly contrasting terrain. But if we go to the that was kind of the purpose behind slide two, to kind of show you the context of Hyperion and up against, compare it to other satellites, just looking over it. But if we go to slide three, we see that from the ground, it doesn't look extremely unique or impressive, but it is also very hard to observe. This is often due to due to Saturn's scattered light and the scattered light from the rings. The two images on the left are from Saturn ring plane crossing in 1995. That's a good time to observe the moons from the ground because of the profile of the rings, the scattered light from the rings is minimized. If you catch Hyperion when it's far from the planet, you can take longer exposures and integrate longer, collect spectra. On the lower right is shown a early near infrared spectra from Brown in 1985. And the thing about this, of course, is that if you take spectra from the ground, you can't resolve Hyperion. Not even with the Hubble Space Telescope, it's too small. So you get just a fully convolved spectra. Every part is blended. It's a blended spectra of the entire disk, and so subtle features are going to be probably blended away, or are more likely to be blended away. You have to have higher sensitivity in order to see them, and of course you don't know where they fall, whether they correspond to light or dark terrain and whatnot. But you can still tell some very interesting things. For example, this spectrum here shows absorption features near 2 and 1.6 or 1.7 microns. It looks like 1.7 in this figure. But and those correspond to water ice bands. And that was fairly exciting at the time. When Voyager visited Hyperion, the Voyager spacecraft, Peter probably recognizes this figure very well. We found, of course, that there was variegated terrain, very high contrast terrain. The satellite was irregular. That's when we discovered that it tumbled chaotically. Now, initially, there were a few subsequent observations from the ground also helped to really solidify that Hyperion was rotating chaotically. That was really as a result of the Voyager encounters. And so...
Can I interrupt you with a question?
Yes.
Okay, the views on slide 4, the Hyperion, or the Voyager view.
Yes.
And I don't know if this is here or not here, but I'm just wondering now, how does this side of Hyperion that we're looking at, say on the upper left, do you know, is that the same view that we're looking at with Cassini on the first slide, that famous image?
I think that, do you see that rim
on the
lower, in the middle image on the right,
okay.
and then again on the lower left, I think that rim is the rim of that kind of ledge that we see towards the top again,
okay.
If I'm not mistaken, I think that's right.
Right.
Is that right, Peter?
And are we seeing that same rim on slide 2?
On slide 2, no. That's the other side of it, more or less. It's at a different angle. Is that rim, Peter, you could probably help. Is that rim the one?
Right. The slide 2 picture on the left is way around on the other side from the usual, the lead-in sponge picture and the Voyager pictures that you had.
Okay.
And then on slide 2, that inset of high resolution does go not with the one on the left of slide 2, but with those other usual sponge views that you
right.
had.
Okay.
So,
Actually, I have one more question.
Yes.
Sorry.
That's okay.
On the spectrum on slide 3,
Yes.
I usually think of the water ice scan being at 1.5 and 2 microns. It looks a little shifted here. Is that real or meaningful?
I wondered about that looking at this earlier. I think this data was actually taken with a CVF wheel, and so it looks like there may have been some wavelength calibration issues with that.
They still attributed it to water ice.
I believe they did. Yes. Yeah. So, let's see. Yep. Okay. So if we go to slide 5, I see there are three views of Hyperion with three different instruments with Cassini, and the top one is the VIMS a VIMS data cube taken at about 8,800 angstroms, roughly, and the lower left hand view is a UVIS data, the ultraviolet imaging spectrometer, and of course the imaging science system. ISS camera in the lower, lower central, but the lower left of the, or lower right of the images. If we look at the spectrum that Amanda basically extracted and shown here from Hendricks and Hansen, we see that there's this edge at around 1650 angstroms, and that is typical of water ice. And we see the brightest areas have that strongest edge there, so that the brighter areas are richer in water ice, is what the conclusion is. If we look at the VIMS spectra, we see here, that's in slide 6, the spectra of two different terrains. These are spectra that were averaged over several dark areas and of course over the brighter areas. And we see that the concentration of ice does seem to, surface ice does seem to vary. The dark line or dark dots in these figures, those are the actual cube data, and the red is a spectral fit to the data. The spectral fits are kind of simple models. They're a combination of water ice and organics that were made in the lab to kind of be what we think would be synthesized in the outer solar system. So these are what are called tholins. There's a combination of Titan tholin, which is what we would expect to find, in the environs around Titan. Yes.
Yeah, this is Matthew Oda with the Saturn Observation Campaign.
Hi.
Looking at the composition of Hyperion with the ices, the tholins, and the low density, would you agree that if Hyperion was in the inner solar system, basically would appear as a comet?
If it were in the inner solar system.
Basically form a tail and basically just appears as a comet.
Yeah, you would probably get a large amount of sublimation, certainly with the water, the fraction of water ice.
So
In a gross sense, yes. Yes, it's rich. There are clearly volatiles that, actually I was going to be cover that in the conclusion, but yeah, there are a large fraction of substances which would undergo a large amount of evaporation at distances of, you know, a few AU. So
thank you.
Yeah, sure. So let's see. If so if we look at some of the other features that are present in the spectra, we see CO2 is present in both the light and dark terrain. We see evidence of that. And we see an interesting feature at 2.42 microns, kind of that notch in the spectra. And that corresponds nicely to, it's particularly clear, it's clearer in the lower albedo regions. It seems to stand out more in that spectra. And that corresponds or can be attributed, it matches well with carbon and nitrogen bearing species, basically CN bearing species. And that's an interesting feature. It'll become more interesting as we look at the compositional maps. If we look at the CO2 distribution, we see it is both in the light and dark terrain. Now, this is similar in some respect to the distribution of CO2 we see in Iapetus, but different from what we see in Phoebe. Some other similarities, if we look at the light and dark terrains of Hyperion and those of Iapetus, we find that the dark terrains tend to have a red color in the optical, both in both circumstances. And that's what. But if we also look at the in the near infrared, again, this is slide 9. I guess I'm going through these faster than I thought I would, but maybe I'll get a lot of questions. So, if we look at slide 9, we see that. Oh, okay. So the we see that the match is actually better between for the dark material between that of Phoebe and Iapetus. So the match is good in the optical for the material being of similar origin between Hyperion and Iapetus, but better for the material being of similar origin in between Phoebe and Iapetus when we look at the near-infrared spectrum. Now, if we move to try and map out particular features that we see in the spectra, which is what you can really do with the VIMS, really the strength of VIMS. And other imaging spectrometers, including UVIS, you see a certain correlations and concentrations of different elements. In slide 10, the water ice band depth is labeled blue, okay, in the upper image. The red corresponds to, or the reddest regions correspond to strong CO2 band depths. And the green, that the strength of that 2.42 micron feature that we attribute to CN bearing species. And if we look at the way things are distributed, CO2 actually is
concentrated. Can I ask a question real quick? quick?
Yes. Yes.
The green you said was corresponding to the carbon nitrogen. Is that what you meant? I couldn't hear
yes.
that part.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Yep. Sure. The CO2 is concentrated in certain areas, but it's not concentrated with respect to brightness. Okay. It's concentrated over both bright and dark terrains. And we see that the thing that does correlate very well with the dark terrains are the CN bearing, or the feature that's indicative of CN bearing species. So.
And is this the same type of thing? Are you showing us the same type of thing on page 8?
On page 8, yes, that's the same. That is the same. It's a broader, right.
Right. Okay.
So, it's a larger scale with that. And if you look again at on page 8 or slide 8, you notice of course that the water ice is again correlated with brighter features, and you can see that again with in slide 10 to some extent too. To get back to the CO2 distribution, if we look at the just the spectra of the CO2 bands and compare them to what we found on Iapetus, we find that the bands on Hyperion are shifted somewhat shortward, okay, at shorter wavelengths. And this would imply that there is possibly the species, the CO2 is actually up against other different species than with Iapetus or Phoebe, and that it could also be bound in part with possibly water ice or other molecules, but different molecules than on Iapetus. Now,
is pure CO2 the absorption band?
They're shifted again. That's it can't be. It's not pure CO2. So.
But pure CO2 absorbs it somewhere else other than where we see Hyperion or the Iapetus.
Right. It's shifted to a different position. Okay. In fact, it's at 4.27. I think it's even longer.
And the Iapetus spectrum you're showing is for the dark terrain?
The Iapetus is, I believe, for the dark terrain. I think. It might be the bright terrain there, actually. So, okay. Now, the fact that CO2 even exists at these distances is a bit of a surprise. And we've seen it on several satellites, including Iapetus and Phoebe. The reason why it's odd to actually see CO2 here is that it evaporates fairly quickly. Now, fairly quickly is a relative term, but if you look at the plot on page 12 in the upper right, you see it's a plot of basically evaporation rates in terms of meters per millions of years as a function of distance from the sun. And we look at Saturn's distance is the green line right there, and we find that on the order of tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years, we'd expect any centimeter sized layers to evaporate off of the surface. And so, of course, we're talking about fairly old bodies, And so we would expect that there would be some sort of source of replenishment for the CO2. And you can get CO2 from different sources. You can convert it from CO, and you can get it from ultraviolet radiation breaking up water ice and the oxygen with that, of course, combining with the products broken up of the leftover products of UV breaking up carbonaceous material, and form it that way, or you can form it with impacts, basically. But it's as to what the source actually is again a bit of a mystery. Saturn isn't the only place that we see CO2 where we shouldn't. We see CO2, for example, on Jupiter's satellites as well. And again, that source should not be indigenous. That basically is what I had to talk about with the composition, in terms of the composition. Basically, we see that the dark terrain and the bright terrain both bear CO2 to some extent. The water ice concentration varies, but this CN-bearing feature that we attribute to CN-bearing species tends to correlate well with the dark terrain. So that's pretty much what I had to say. And if there are any more questions, it's fine. And otherwise, if Peter wants to talk about
it. I have a quick question.
Yes.
And that is, let's see. So you see the CO2 in the bright and the dark terrain.
Yes.
But
agree.
I think I was thinking, and maybe I'm getting confused here, but I think I was thinking that CO2 elsewhere. Again, and maybe you said that it mostly occurs in the dark terrain.
On Phoebe, it certainly does, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about, like, on Callisto, like you show on page 13?
Callisto, it's a leading and trailing side asymmetry.
Right.
But I think it's also in the dark terrain, and that's of course, from Hibbett's.
Yeah.
Right there, that figure. Yeah, I think you're right. I believe that's correct. Yeah. Yeah.
This is Matthew with another question.
Yes.
Do you have any idea of the bearing strength of the surface of Hyperion? Say, like, if we ever landed a spacecraft there or sent humans, is it a very frangible surface that you would sink into very slowly, or is there enough, do you think there's enough bearing there to support a spacecraft or a person basically that would set foot on that satellite?
It's a good question, and I think Peter will probably deal with that a little more. It is very low density material. So, Peter, did you want to answer that, or?
I can get to it eventually. I guess two things. It is very low gravity surface, so when you plop a spacecraft down, of course, the spacecraft doesn't weigh very much, so it's not going to give high pressure on what it's sitting on. And of course, this may be ice and all these other, you know, ices of many kinds and volatiles and may have some fine particles, but it's also, you know, below 100 Kelvin, so a lot of that is probably feels more like steel than ice to us. So I doubt that you're going to have major problems of sinking into it, given that it's a little bit, you know, compressed and pulverized by getting hit by impact. It's porous, but it's not perhaps as porous as, say, some
polyps.
So then with the mass of Hyperion, the spacecraft would more likely would be a docking operation than a landing operation.
Although it's a little, it's sort of halfway in between. It's not as bad as some that you'd consider a rendezvous and docking rather than landing.
Okay, thank you.
Fellas, I have a question also on the composite.
Okay.
Yeah, my name is Richard. I'm with Space Science for Schools in Reno, Nevada, and I do space science outreach and education in schools in our local area. And I'm going to be working with students this year on our moon and also doing our moon as a base of comparison to other moons in the solar system. Do we have any evidence of any rocky material or structure to this moon?
The models that we used, okay, did not have silicates as a component.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whether or not, I mean, a lot of the modeling is you pick from what you've sampled and you try it out and whether it can accommodate or not an actual silicate. But the common stuff that we did try, and we did try some, didn't like olivine and other things. We did not see it did not accommodate. So I think in terms of pure rock or high concentrations of silicates, they don't seem to fit very well. But I don't know. Again, if Peter wants to add anything, or I think that's true.
Okay.
So
yeah. So I can pretty much pass on to them with confidence what we're dealing with here is a outer solar system. I mean, outer planet solar system body that's moon that's primarily frozen water and gas at this point.
And organic.
And organic.
Organic material, yeah. Just a lot of ice, though.
Yes,
so,
a lot of ice. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, so should I launch
into
the
ahead
second half?
Come back with composition questions later on, too.
Okay.
Okay, well, I will proceed here, starting with slide 14. These slides were somewhat hastily extracted from something else. We may have to jump around a little bit, but I'm going to be talking about the view of Hyperion from the standpoint of geologists doing photo interpretation on the images, and also using some of the other data that of course geologists sort of need. Composition is obviously one of them, and mass is another. And this slide, number 14, is actually a summary or pretty much all of the good Voyager views of Hyperion with the shape model developed from the Voyager data superimposed. And Voyager made a fairly leisurely, Voyager 2 made a fairly leisurely flyby through, and Hyperion being modestly far away from Saturn, there were actually a few days when you could more or less resolve the object, and a couple of days when you could see the some surface features. And the surface features changed a little bit, so you're obviously changing position, and there had been some notion that maybe it was not in synchronous rotation and maybe even chaotic, although that idea was just coming in at the time. And the initial during the encounter, when everything is all hectic and people are, you know, writing press releases and quick science articles and things, basically we described Hyperion and let go the question of what the rotation really was. It didn't really seem to be synchronous with its rotation around Saturn. And Well, I think it was a few months later that Tom Duxbury went and did some stereo control models on this and came out with that it was actually spinning around its long axis, not pointing anywhere near Saturn, which was very unexpected. Of course, no one believed his answer since it was not spinning very much. It was a very unusual answer, and then that sort of sat that way for about a decade, and then some more light curve studies by Jim Claviter and other people, and then reanalysis of Voyager data indicated that, in fact, this thing likely was in chaotic rotation, which basically means that you can watch it spinning for a while, but predicting what it will its spin state will be fair amount of time in the future is extremely uncertain. And it means that the orientation of the spin axis changes in space, and it means that the orientation of the spin axis changes within the body, which creates all sorts of interesting problems by later with Cassini. let's see. Okay, so let's go to slide 15, which is just another introductory thing, just to remind us of some things. The interesting part has already been mentioned, and Cassini being in its orbit, which changes around Saturn and is sometimes tweakable to get you near objects of choice, one of them being Hyperion. Nearly 2 years ago now, it doesn't seem like that, got within about 500 kilometers of Hyperion, and the close flybys are, of course, designed to do several things, give you the highest resolution from the remote sensing instruments, and then also, if possible, to track the spacecraft and get a mass as you fly close. And all that was done, good pass. There had been some other passes before and since, sort of on the order of 500,000 kilometers or less, when you can also resolve surface features, but nothing as good as the really close pass. When you fly that several kilometers per second, a few hundred kilometers away, actually tracking the object with this humongous spacecraft with all the instruments nailed onto it, rather than on scan platforms, generally you're not going to be taking pictures at the closest approach, and so I think it was like 2,300 kilometers or so was the minimum range at which we were taking images. So successful flyby, lots of views at other times with this thing in chaotic rotation, giving you unpredictable faces every time you flew by because you couldn't predict the rotation. All right, now let's see. The third slide that I've got, number 16, actually, what I should probably do is skip to number 17. Okay. And to actually do things like map surface features and find the volume of the object for determining mean density and other things, of course, we do have to deal with this rotation. And so it meant that each one of the passes, including the close pass, identify surface features. And you see an example here of a couple of views from the September 2005 flyby with so-called control points marked on craters. In these two views, you can tell a little bit there's been some rotation of Hyperion between the left and the right, and some of the crater on the right bottom has started to come into.
Excuse me, may I ask a question?
Yep.
Yes, my name is Samantha Harvey. I'm a writer here at JPL. A science writer, and I'm writing a story about this. I need to know, when you're talking about rotation within the body, that's why your control points change? Is that what you're referring to? I'm a little bit confused from slides, from slide, the previous slide to this slide.
Well, let's do this slide, and then I'm going to go back to the other one. But
okay.
You got these different views here. Spacecraft's flying by. You don't quite know which way it's spinning when you go by. And so what you do is you look at all different views during the spacecraft moving and the object is spinning. And so you mark
Correct. Right. Okay.
Things in the two things, and then you have ways of solving for which way the object itself is spinning and how fast it's spinning.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
And what changes, it actually turns out that the rate at which it spins, for some reason we've gotten in the habit of, on Hyperion, of measuring this in degrees per day, and it's around 72 degrees per day, which basically means it takes about 5 of our days to spin once. So it's sort of slow. You can use all these, you know, a couple of hundred points on here to determine what we would call an instantaneous spin vector at this one time of which way it's spinning. And you look at all the other times and you find out that, well, this spin vector has in fact changed quite a bit. The rate sort of stays the same, but the direction in which its, say, North Pole is pointing changes quite a bit. And I will show that in a...
Thank you. That was helpful. Thank you very much.
Table numbers later. So anyway, this slide number 17 is just to give you a view that, you know, you can tell that the lighting has changed just a little bit, especially on the right there, just a few hours later. And you know, there are a whole bunch of things that you go through and you mark, and then let the fancy software figure out which way the thing is actually spinning. So now we should back up to the previous one, and of course, then when you have the spin, you know the relative geometry of the spacecraft and any point on the surface, and that's when you can do things like make a shape model and start measuring things on the surface and counting up craters and doing anything that sort of really requires a global map or knowledge of sort of the global shape. And so with all these different views, you can make partial shape models and then stitch them all together, which was a lot of fun. But anyway, the numbers on Hyperion here, the mean radius, which is just the radius of a sphere that has the same volume, since this thing is very irregularly shaped, have to have some common definition of an average radius. 135 kilometers, there's some uncertainty in there, largely because of having to stitch these different views together, and you're a little unsure to a couple of degrees of what the orientation of the spin is. The range of diameters there is pretty impressive. It's nearly a factor of 2. And then the really important number, which comes from the mass, which the radio science and the navigation people actually worked independently, actually by different techniques, but also involving the tracking the radio as went by or in multiple passes, is a little bit more than half that of water. And since we've heard that it's likely to be made largely of water ice, this implies that it's highly porous on the inside, probably more than 40% pore space.
Peter?
Yep.
Is it grams per meter cube then?
In grams, yes, kilograms, not kilometers.
Kilograms, okay. Kilograms.
Yeah, sorry. Okay, I suppose everywhere. But anyway, 540 kilograms per meter cubed, and that translates into, you know, half a gram per cubic centimeter. And the other thing that translates into is sort of an average surface gravity of about 2 centimeters per second squared. So that's 2 tenths of a cent of Earth. So that's a very low surface acceleration. All right, so let's skip forward 2 slides here to more numbers. And don't worry about this table too much, other than on the left-hand side is just the dates of various observations, different flybys and parts of flybys. You can see 2005, and then day 160, 161, and so forth. Different times, so with, you know, days duration, there's an orientation of right ascension and declination of which way it's spinning, and the rate in degrees per day in which it's spinning is sort of roughly the same. Actually, the most interesting thing is this right-hand column called SS lat, which means subsolar latitude, which means if you're standing on the the equator of the object that is 90 degrees away from the pole latitude-wise, is what's the latitude of the sun, or what's the season? That's basically the definition of season, is where the latitude of the sun is. And you can see the sun goes from way south to moderately north on this. And that's mostly motion of the spin axis in the sky. Some of that is the motion of the spin axis within the object. But that's just a good indication of just how much the orientation of this spin changes. Over just a few months. Okay, going on. Okay, I guess I've already sort of dealt with things implied in slide 19 about the porosity. Okay, if it's mostly water ice, then you sort of got low 40% pore space within it. If you are mixing higher density materials to any significant degree, then that, which are denser than water ice would be, then the porosity would go even more. And of course, maybe this may be time for a compositional question from me, in the sense of what are the constraints on, say, the possible fractions of the CO2 and organics and such like that. My suspicion is they're it's hard to tell, and they may be low. But is that true?
CO2, it's harder to tell. But water ice is actually pretty good, pretty easy to constrain. And in the bright material, I mean, again, we're looking at just the surface. The bright material, it's over 80%, and in the dark material, it's under 15%. It's actually 14% in the models. Does that answer your question, kind of?
Yeah. Okay, so in terms of densities, I mean, this is a low density. It's not the lowest density that's so far been measured for a putatively icy satellite in the Saturn system. Some of the ring-related satellites do have lower densities, although they have some fairly large error bars, but some of them may be down on the order of 0.4 or perhaps even less grams per cubic centimeter. And so Hyperion may be unique in some of the attributes. The presence of the low density sort of by itself does not necessarily set it apart from everything else. It may be a combination of other things. So let's go on to the next slide, 2020, which is just sort of three views. There's the, it's now a classical sponge view of Hyperion on the left. The upper right is an attempt at sort of a true visual color image of it, and I guess we saw a version of this before. This, the B is, you take the view on A and sort of go a long ways around to the right, about 100 and some degrees, and that's sort of what you get of that view. The view in C is sort of in between the two. You can see the top of B is also visible, sort of the top right of C, some common areas. The bite taken out on the left side of panel C is actually what's starting to take a bite out of the lower right-hand side of A, just to sort of line those up. And the key thing about these other views taken on other passes is help you define the shape and hence the mean density. You know, they also confirm that this pattern of dark material in the bottom of craters and other depressions is a global phenomenon. It's not stuck in just the one area there that you happen to see at high resolution.
Peter, I'm sorry I missed it, but how do B and A relate then? Where's B compared to A?
Let's see. If you take the view of A and sort of go around to the right hand side about 130 degrees or so, then you get to the B. It's actually sort of easier to go A C D, in the sense that the bite on the lower right hand side of A is the bite on the lower left-hand side of C, and you've gone, 100 and some degrees around on the bottom. So C is sort of looking back toward A side there, and then you go up on C to the upper right, the upper right of C you can recognize in the upper part of B.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
Just a little hard just because of the way B's rotated to actually get B and A hooked up directly, unless you sort of really know like one tiny little crater there. And all of that still doesn't cover the entire object, but that's about slightly more than two-thirds of it, and there are some other images that then cover the rest. But that'll give you an example of really sort of the difficulty navigating around here. When you come by another time, you don't know which way you're going to look, and the spin axis in different places. You've got to get used to what it looks like. But the key thing is these dark things distributed all over. Okay, so now actually on to sponges in slide 21. Should have gotten some different view than this thing we're constantly looking at here, but it's still nonetheless good to look at. So we had the flyby, and everyone said how odd this thing looked. And, it looks different. Something's going on. Why does it look like a sponge? Maybe there's odd surface processes going on, eroding things. Certainly one of the first comments was it looks like sun cups on a glacier, where sublimation, and especially collection of dark material in the bottom of pits, is sort of a positive feedback effect to sort of make deeper holes by sublimating and expansion of pits. But this is pretty cold out here, and there are lots of craters on here. So one of the first things that we just did was say, okay, let's go actually map things that really truly look like impact craters and segregate them from other types of depressions that might exist. And the criterion is that you have a distinct rim, that they cut other features, and more or less circular. And when you go do that, go through and map them all out, you're actually not left with too many things left over other than the craters that you map. So the immediate, just sort of simple mapping discovery was, well, what you're looking at here, odd as it may be, is a collection of impact craters. And the question is sort of, why does this collection of impact craters look different from many others other than perhaps the fact they have dark material in the bottom. We go to slide 22, and this is not the best attempt to compare three different small, irregularly shaped objects at roughly the same scale. Hyperion, with one of its craters, big craters, and lots of other ones. Phoebe on the upper left, and Telesto on the lower right. They really do look different. Telesto on the lower right really seems to have sort of buried itself. See sort of some ghost craters that are pretty well filled in. Very nice looking craters. Some of them may be slightly conical. Certainly very lunar look to it. Hyperion has a different look here. It has lots of craters. It has some rims on the craters. It has some debris which you can see moving downslope into craters. It doesn't have much in the way of ejecta blocks that you can see. It doesn't, although there are raised rims on craters, there's certainly nothing that immediately strikes you as being due to ejecta from craters. And there may be more, there turns out there are more sort of intermediate sized craters on Hyperion. So we go to the next slide, which is one of these usual horrible so-called R plots of crater densities on objects, which R means relative to a particular slope. The only thing you need to worry about on this plot here is it goes from 100 meters to more than 100 kilometers in diameter on the bottom, and then the relative crater density on the vertical axis. The dark symbols are for various counts on Hyperion, and the open symbols are for Phoebe. And between 1 and 10 kilometers, just note that there are more craters on Hyperion than there are on Phoebe by about a factor of 2. as being a log plot. And so the real difference between what Hyperion looked like and what these other ones look like is, one, it has more of these 2 to 10 kilometer craters, and two, they are individually sort of well preserved. They have nice rims. They may not have big ejecta blocks or blankets or blocks around them, but they do have nice, slightly bright rims, which we've seen on several of these images.
Can I ask a question really quickly? Would that imply that these are younger because of the more distinct rims?
Well, individually, what it implies is for each, you know, if you have a collection of well-preserved rims, it would be younger in the sense that, yes, in the sense that they have not been eroded. Now, the things that usually erode craters are other craters. And so, but if you have a lot of young craters, then you've had lots of time to accumulate these, and they're not necessarily young. So what it says is that there's some erosional process which typically operates on Phoebe and apparently also on the moon, since Phoebe looks like the moon, that does not eat away at the rims and the bottoms of craters on Hyperion as well as you might suspect. And if we go to the next slide, number 24, after lots of the way some of this, we did the crater counts and sort of got, okay, well, there's a different crater density, and so, you know, it's more, maybe it's older, maybe it's something else, but it was just clear that the impression, the visual impression derived from a lot of these intermediate-sized craters that were themselves pretty well preserved, that they're not as rounded off as, say, the ones on Phoebe were, and sort of fussed around with that a while, and of course, being on Cassini that's flying by other satellites, when you're working on satellite science, you get started on one object, and then you get a little ways on that, and then a spacecraft flies by another satellite, and everybody runs off and tries to work on that and forgets what they were doing. So it took a long time to get around to some other things, one of which was just the usual geological thing, of just going back and contemplating what's really in the images. And the key element here is the image on the left of slide 24, which is a real close-up of the bottom of one of these craters that has this dark material in the bottom part of the crater. The crater itself is pretty old. Its rim has certainly been beaten down some more than some others. And when you stretch these images rather ferociously to bring out what's in the dark material, you see, lo and behold, that the dark bottoms of these craters are themselves very heavily cratered with small impact. And what that really says is, okay, the bottom surface is old, it's been accumulating lots of these small craters, and which means that the bottom of that crater has not suffered very much sedimentation of stuff filling it in. It hasn't suffered very much erosion, say, from sublimation. After the big crater, whose rim is outside of this picture, was formed. And so you get a picture here of, okay, well, the 2 to 10 kilometer craters are sort of well preserved and sitting there, and see in the bottom of big ones, they're accumulating lots of the small ones. So what's going on is, yes, you're still accumulating craters, but there's really nothing else that's eroding things in any great degree, other than on these very steep slopes where you get some landslides, which the right-hand picture there sort of emphasizes that some of those big slopes, and, you know, you do have landslides. But this is a picture of stuff in distinction from, say, the moon or Phoebe or other things. There just doesn't seem to be much extra material that's sort of flying around and